everyone. I'm going to make a start. I just want to start by saying that the 16th of December last month was the centenary of the unveiling of the Vrouwen Monument in Bloemfontein, the Women's Monument in Bloemfontein. And this book was published in commemoration of that event. The book is edited by Bill Nassen, and I'm sure some of you have been to his courses here, and Albert Crinlan, who's professor of history at Stellenbosch. I contributed a couple of chapters, and there are a number of chapters, but Albert Crinlan particularly has written quite a lot about the genesis of the Vrouwen Monument and the meaning of the Vrouwen Monument in the latter part of the book. It's got gorgeous pictures in it. It's a beautifully designed book. So I thought it's only fair to draw your attention to it and give it a little bit of a plug. And I will be drawing a little bit on it during the course of the lectures. The other thing is that I've had a number of questions from people, some of which are quite complicated. I'm going to try and answer a couple of them in the course of the lecture, and then at the end I'll also try and respond to some of them. Okay, so let's turn now to the last stages of the camps. The war ended officially on the 31st of May of 1901 with the signing of the Treaty of Vereeniging in Pretoria, Melrose House. And the treaty dealt with the whole question of repatriation. Articles 2 and 10 of the treaty set down the terms of repatriation. Two central repatriation boards were established in the two new colonies, and in each district there was a commission of local inhabitants headed by somebody like the local resident magistrate. Milner didn't want the camps shut down from the 31st of May. He realized that because the farms had been destroyed, people wouldn't be able to maintain themselves, so it would take time to get people home and get people able to establish themselves. With great reluctance, the War Office agreed to fund both the camps and the repatriation to the end of December 1902. And the last of the camps then closed in early, I think the last was about February of 1903. So it was the process of repatriation then takes place over a period of 6 to 8 months. It's quite a slow process. But the odd thing is that even in the last months of the war, the British officials behaved as if the camps were going to be there forever. And they do a whole series of things which suggest that they're looking at permanent settlements. So they erect a whole lot of new camps. This is Meerbank Camp, Jacob Siding, Wentworth, Moy River, which was never occupied. All of those camps were built in Natal. In the Cape, there was Kabusi, Uitenhagen, East London. So they're doing that. And at this point, I'm going to just touch on one of the questions I got, which was about barbed wire. Somebody asked me about barbed wire in these camps. The camps were not officially fenced in. The British line all along was that these were not prisons. The camp inmates should be free to come and go into the local towns, for instance, with permits. As I said, this was a permit-controlled society under martial law. Over time, many of the camps did get barbed wire. They were fenced in, but the reason for that was twofold. One was often to keep British soldiers out. They didn't want young British soldiers wandering around at these camps of young Boer women. And the other one, in some cases, was to keep Boer commandos out, because some of the camps, Aliwal North was raided, Petersburg was raided, so they were trying to get a bit more control. But nearly always, the decision to fence the camps came not from the camp authorities, but from the military authorities. So some camps are never fenced, some are gradually fenced, but it wasn't a camp decision when they were fenced, it was always a military decision. So they're building new camps then. They start planting trees. 25,000 trees were ordered for the Orange River Colony camps, and there's a tree being planted in Frederfort Road camp. They start to replace the tents with solid buildings, and there's a whole great brickwork set up in nearly all of the camps. So, as for instance, Kronstadt camp had 18 brickmakers turning out 100,000 bricks a month And you get this sort of statement about improvements, and the camps are going ahead daily. We've now got about 12 cottages finished, and they're moving the old people into these cottages. So there are those kinds of improvements going on. And a whole lot of these shops, as they called them, were set up. Carpenters, bootmakers, the brickmakers, all sorts of people actually doing crafts. And in addition to this, young boys of 12 and upwards, would be apprenticed to these people to start to learn trades. So they've got this educational process again. And they began to grow vegetables, and quite substantial vegetable gardens were established in almost all of the camps, with varying degrees of success, depending, I think, on accessibility of water and drought, which is always, of course, a consideration in South Africa. So you've then got, as far as the British are concerned, a situation where they almost behave as if the camps are permanent. Very odd. The situation for the Boers was very different. Although the British must have anticipated the end of the war, they knew the end of the war was coming, the Boers did not. One must remember here that the camps were very isolated. Many of the Boers got very little information about what was going on in the war. And I think they, part of their survival technique, in a way, was to believe that their cause was just and must ultimately end in victory. And it's this that sustains them all through the war. So when they heard that the Boers had surrendered, many were absolutely grief-stricken. And you get this sort of statement over and over again from the Boers, that they couldn't believe that their leaders had surrendered. And this is our friend Strydom in Brandfort camp, finishing up by saying that this war is going to be fought to the bitter end. He doesn't believe it's not going to end in victory. And then when it happens, at last peace is declared, but what a peace. We've lost our country. Death would have been preferable. So they are grief-stricken. And the Boer generals had the very unpleasant task of going round to all the camps and explaining to the camp inmates the terms of the peace and why they had surrendered. And it must have been an appalling task, because over and over again you keep getting these stories about how they're greeted either with complete silence or with anger and hostility. So it was an extremely difficult task to persuade the camp people that they're going to go home and that they have lost the war. The camps were used in the whole repatriation process. The men on commando came into the camps before they go home, and the prisoners of war who are now overseas in places like Bermuda, St. Helena, Ceylon, India, are brought back to the camps as well. They come back to South Africa and then they're sent to the camps to rejoin their families before the whole family is sent out to the farms. They didn't want to send women and children out to the farms on their own. There's got to be a male. There's got to be a head of the family. So if they can produce an adult male, they can go home. But many of them have to wait a long time, because some of the bitter anger men refused to take the oath of allegiance, which all men had to take. And they stayed in the camps sometimes till the end of 1902. Some, of course, as we know, refused ever to come back and went off to places like Argentina, a handful of them. But on the whole, most of them came back through the camps. The Irene superintendent had a taste for colourful prose. I have to say that this is the sign of a bad superintendent. Good superintendents didn't have time for writing these lengthy reports. They just sent in these terse reports. But this guy, he's got an eye for a scene, and so he puts in this kind of description of people, the men coming back from commando. Men and women and children thronged the boundary, gazed intensely along the road whence the surrendered burghers were expected to arrive. The dust of horsemen seen afar upon the road was the signal of expectant surmise among the women and children who were looking for long-vanished faces. At that strange meeting place, before the suppressed excitement of several thousand people, the mother found her child, the wife her husband, the sister her brother. There was none of the loud hurrahs or tumult of shouting that usually characterise a British crowd, and you get this story often. The hands of the heroes, for such they were accounted, were shaken cordially by the men, and as heartily were their lips kissed by the women. So he's got this picture for the relief to see your men again. The process of repatriation, as I said, was quite a slow process. Every returning family was given a tent and a month's supply of rations, and they could come back for more if they needed more. But the real difficulty also lay in transport. You've got to remember that this is a country which is now denuded of animals, and denuded of oxen, denuded of horses, of transport animals. And so often it was months before they could get together enough transport to take everybody home. Because a wagon would go off with its oxen, and if there's only one or two for a camp, they could go off for a week to take some families and then come back and take people out again. So it was a slow process, and it's partly why it took so long. And in the end, of course, the camp slowly closed down, and those who were left were the very poor, the destitute, the old, who had no family to support them, some of the disabled in a similar position, and the orphans. And the orphans were a matter of special consideration, both for the British and for the poor. And as far as the British are concerned, this occurs within quite an interesting changing context, because by 1900, the way people think about children is beginning to alter. We're moving into much more of a child-centered world. And so the British took a fair amount of care to see that those children either went to relatives who could care for them properly, or they set up these orphanages. This is actually Norval's Pond, but these kids were then shifted to Brandfort. And in the end, the last orphanage was an Irene camp, and that lasted certainly well into 1903, if not longer. I'm not quite sure when the Irene orphanage closed. But I thought this again is my camp photographer from Norval's Pond. But you can see these are children that are being taken care of, I think. They've got decent clothing. They're all dressed in a uniform, of course, but they look as if they are being looked after. It's quite a lot of staff caring for them. The Boers themselves, of course, were also very concerned about the children, and some of the Dutch Reformed churches in the Cape appealed to be able to take children as well, and some children were sent to places like Worcester and Wellington, where they were fostered also in Afrikaner families. So that left the destitute. And we know quite a lot about this, partly because of this man, Lawrence Richardson, who was a Quaker, who toured the country at the end of the war and left an account of the desolation that he found. What they did in the Free State was to set up relief works, the conventional thing you do when you need to provide for the destitute. Able-bodied men have to work for their relief. And there were about three of these building dams and roads in the Free State. One was Mushroom Valley Relief Camp near Winburg. And Lawrence Richardson describes this one. About 1,000 people, that's quite a lot of destitute people being provided for, living in sod huts. Although the appearance was not as tidy as the concentration camps, he thought life was more wholesome. The people had regular occupation and regular wages and were free to leave when they wished. The greatest difficulty was the lack of occupation for young women. But he couldn't see any future for this. Relief works are a temporary measure. The greatest benefit, he thought, was the new habit of regular manual work. In the Transvaal, they had a couple of relief works, but they also quite imaginatively tried to set up a land settlement scheme in conjunction with wealthier Boer farmers. And essentially, this was sharecropping that they were trying to set up. And there were quite a number of these schemes in the beginning. They helped to empty the camps. People moved out of them quite quickly because they had land to go to. But in the long run, the farms were not a success. They suffered, one observer says, from a deadly combination of exploitation and bureaucracy. And within about 5 years, there were only a couple of hundred people left on these lands, left within these schemes. The great majority of people, of course, returned to their farms, and it's estimated that about 30,000 farms were burnt during the war. They weren't wholly without resources. They were provided with food. The government provided them with grain and some implements to get them started. Quite a number of farmers had been able to get receipts from the British Army, and they could claim compensation. There's a lot of bitterness about the way in which compensation was paid out. And there are also very good records on compensation claims, which tell you a whole lot about how people perceived their society before the war. But quite a lot of people at least got some money coming in to start up again. Nevertheless, of course, the reality for most people was bitter hardship for years after the war. One of the questions which I had was about the demographic impact of the war and the camps on Boer society. And I'm just going to pause and say a little bit about it, but it takes a little bit of time because it's a slightly complicated explanation. If you take a census and you put in the numbers of people at each age and you turn it into a bar chart, you get this kind of thing. These used to be called population pyramids. And what you've got here is the Free State white population in 1890. And this is an almost a classic pre-industrial age pyramid, population pyramid, where you've got a high birth rate and a high infant mortality rate. And you get a slightly longer peak in the Free State and the Transvaal than you do in pre-industrial Europe, where people don't live quite as long, interestingly. You get a slightly longer lifespan in this. But this is what you get in both the Free State and the Transvaal in 1890. The British did a very good census in 1904, and that's the Orange River Colony in 1904. It's very difficult just on a graph to say what's going on, but you can see that something extraordinary has happened to the children. And what we are looking at a lost generation here, a very substantial loss of younger people in that society. And the Transvaal one is even odder. The Transvaal, these pyramids, which where you've got both males and females, are not actually comparable because the male population of the Transvaal was substantially larger than that of the female population, and especially the male population on the Rand, where you've got young immigrant males working on the mines. So it's a very distorted, and they're not comparable. But nevertheless, again, you can see something has happened to that classic population pyramid. There's a huge loss, and it looks like, I think this is a distortion, so it's because of the oddity of the male population. But again, you've got a loss of young people between birth and about 15 or 20. One of the questions that I got was about the long-term effect of this. If this had not happened, would not the white population of South Africa have been very much larger? Now, that's a complicated question to answer, but I would make one point first of all, that the Afrikaner population of South Africa had a double blow, because in 1918, of course, came the flu epidemic. The flu, the 1918 flu, was most severe, affected most severely young adults. It's precisely that group of children who have survived the camps are reaching young adulthood by 1918, and then they die again. And I suspect, although we've got absolutely no evidence for it, that they may very well have had compromised health because of their experiences of the camps. If they've had measles and their lungs are damaged and then they get the flu, they might well have been much more susceptible. So there is a double blow demographically to Afrikaners in the first part of the 20th century. But it's very difficult to extrapolate from that. I think what my questioner suggested that perhaps we would have been looking at a white population of about 19 million. But one of the things that's left out of this is the question of what's known as the demographic transition or the fertility transition. We know from demographic work done in this country that in 1900 South African whites had British and Boer, but especially Boer, had not yet reached the phase of the demographic transition where families become smaller. By the 1920s, they have moved into that. So that kind of extrapolation is very tricky because I think it leaves out the fact that you are now beginning to get smaller families anyway. And there are a whole lot of other reasons for saying it's very difficult to... You can say, yes, there's this population loss, but how to explain the impact of that population loss is very, very difficult. Just to give you one kind of example, for instance, I was very interested in Russian history, and I wondered about what happened to Russia, because I did an estimate to try and work out what the population loss was in Russia in the 20th century, and I came out at about 90 million over that century. It's one hell of a lot of people. And I have asked Russian historians how that affected their society. And they look blank. And then the one answer I've had is that possibly the consequence is that the Muslim population of as we move east, was larger in proportion to the Christian population than it might have been. But beyond that, it's very difficult to tell what the impact is of population loss. So one can't at this stage do much more than observe it. It needs a lot more work. One of the things that I tried to do when I was looking at the camps was to think about the psychological impact of the camps. Historians don't like it. And I have to say that my male colleagues especially get very twitchy when you try to sort of move into the area of psychological history. No evidence for it. That's an uncomfortable area to go in. But I've rashly ventured a little into this field, partly because there is quite a lot of literature about the impact of the Holocaust camps and the impact on the women and children the Dutch women and children particularly, who were in the Japanese prisoner of war camps in the Second World War. There's no question in my mind that many of the women in the camps during the period of the camps suffered from depression, struggled with their faith. And this is from the diary of Tante Mim Fischer, who left this Kamp Dagboek. She was in Standard at camp and then she was moved down to Meerbank. And to me, a lot in her diary suggests that she's struggling with her faith. She's struggling with depression. And I'm sure that this was very common. She's just more articulate than many of them. And so you get these sort of statements in her diary. What about all the prayers and petitions that were sent to God all these months, all the blood and tears, all the misery endured in the hope and belief that deliverance would be assured? Nothing has come of it. If the Lord has not had mercy on the thousands, how will he remember one miserable soul like me? Oh, how the survival of our country would have strengthened my faith. So you can get a sense here of the way in which people are struggling with this. And there are other records which also suggest both depression, a struggle with faith, and sometimes a working through to some kind of management of all this. But just to get back to the Holocaust camps, there's a woman called Erika Apfelbaum. There was a conference here at UCT about 1994 on truth and reconciliation, in which a number of people gave papers on trauma and memory. And this woman, who is a Holocaust survivor, talks quite interestingly about the need to communicate what has happened to you, to communicate trauma. And she says here, for instance, that social communication is vital to our social balance. As long as they do not report their devastating experiences, survivors of abuses of human rights and mass violence live in a no-person's land of silence, where the experiences of the past receive no legitimation. The memories become deeply buried and induce a sort of dissociation between the individual's private and public persona. So this may be one explanation then for the reason why so many illiterate Boer women, women who are not accustomed to writing, who are trying to write in a language which is a home dialect. They are not sophisticated women, they're not speaking Boer Hollands. They are women writing in what is still a kind of a Kombuistaal, in early Afrikaans. They don't have a framework for writing. They don't have an educated mind which teaches you how to structure what you're saying. And so they often follow a formula in their testimonies. There's a sort of set of things that you know that you've got to say when you're explaining what's happened to you. And a chap called Gerard Termoshuizen, who was a Hollander writing about the Dutch survivors of the Japanese camps, makes the same comment about their testimonies, that again, these people often use a formula to explain what has happened to them, because it gives you some way of organizing these experiences. So you get quite a lot of these testimonies. Many of them are published later on, as I mentioned at the beginning, but it's these very early ones that I thought I would just say a very little bit about. This is one from this collection, the Transvala Collection, W19, in the Pretoria archives. And in Transvala, which was an early Afrikaans newspaper just after the war, in about 1904 or so, solicited these, asked women to write in with accounts of what happened to them. And so you get all these accounts written by these women. Some of them are very difficult to read. The handwriting's poor. The language is difficult to make out. Some of them write them out, on the other hand, neatly. They've got themselves a nice school notebook, and you see they've written it out all in their best handwritings. So you get quite a variety. Elizabeth Neertlum, who wrote a book called, well, in Afrikaans her book's called Vergeten. No, Mach ons Vergeet. Used a number of these, but she edits them. She translates them into sober Afrikaans, into pure Afrikaans. She polishes them and makes them much easier to read. But it's these sort of texts which I think tell you something about the people's need to tell the story. They're not easy to read and to use, and I feel they've been underused, and also that I, as a historian, don't have the skills. It takes, I think, particular skills to make proper use of this material. So far, nobody's really used it. But to turn to this question of the impact of the war on the women's psyches, there's another element too, which is a tricky thing to talk about, but it appears in almost every single one of these testimonies. And this is the Zwart Gevaar story, the fear, the anger about the position of black people. Gewapende koffers is the term that's often used in many, many of the testimonies. Running as a thread through Southern African history is the story of the Black Peril Panics. I couldn't find anything very well to illustrate it except this book, which is actually about Zimbabwe, and it's about a black panic and so sexual crime in southern Rhodesia in the 1920s and 30s, I think it was. No, 1902 to 1935, she writes. Now, the point about these sort of black peril panics, and it's a subject which has attracted quite a lot of historians, there's quite a lot of literature about it, is that conventionally this is seen not so much as a concern about black men attacking white women as about white masculinity threatened because of their inability to protect the virtue of their white women. So it's often conveyed, it's written about by men, the whole panic is carried forward by men. So you'll get people being lynched, or you'll get people being arrested and tried on very dubious evidence, those sort of things, in these kind of panics. Now, that's not what happens in the camps. There's something totally different going on in the camps. Because in the camps, it's not the men who are participating in this, it's the women. It's the women who write about gewapende koffers. It's the women who write about cheeky, arrogant Africans and their humiliation at being insulted by Africans. There was one episode during the war, this so-called Devdepoort massacre, which created enormous fear at the beginning of the war amongst Afrikaner communities, and it was very early in November 1899 when a group of the Khatla-Tswana people under Lentschwe attacked a Boer lager. And two women were killed and 17 women, women and children were taken captive, and I must say released quite quickly. But this spread a panic through Boer society. But it's the women who talk about this. It's particularly the women who go into Mafeking camp. They often mention this episode. They mention their fear of being left alone on the farms and the possibility of a recurrence of this kind of attack. The men do not, interestingly enough. And I can give you one example of this. General Ben Boer, who wrote his memoirs, said, for instance, the behavior of the Pilansberg Kaffirs was by no means typical of that of the general native population of the country, or else so many women and children could never have stayed unmolested by themselves on isolated farms. Now, it's not to say that there weren't incidents of molestation. We know they were. But that's not what we're so much concerned with. It's the way the men and the women are seeing this differently. And I think it's partly that the men could not afford a moral panic at this stage, precisely because they were going off on commando and leaving their women and children unprotected. So I'm talking about an attitude of mind, not what's actually happening on the ground. There's just one last point to make about the women and children, and that about the women particularly, and some of the people here have mentioned this to me. Some people leave these testimonies, many of the people never say anything at all. They don't speak about their camp experiences after the war. What you get actually is silence. And Anki Kroch discusses this in that same conference when she writes about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And she notes that many of the women who were giving evidence at the commission don't speak of themselves. They portray themselves as the mothers or the wives of the victims. They translate the trauma from themselves to other people. And I think something of this is also going on in the women's testimonies, where they often don't speak about the grief of the loss of their children. They talk about the destruction of their homes, they talk about the cold, they talk about the awful food, they talk about the insolence of the Africans, they talk about the cruelty of the British or the Hensorpers. There's a sort of transference going on where they talk about it at all. As I say, this is all suggestions about what is going on. It's not something you can kind of prove with hard evidence. After the war, the Boer leaders were confronted with major problems, especially the question of reconciliation. By the end of the war, there were nearly as many Boers fighting for the British as there were still on commando, something like 5,000 or 6,000 fighting for the British and about the same number on commando. So there was a huge problem of reconciling Afrikaner people. It's something that exercised Louis Botha particularly. But some people felt that the losses in the camps especially ought to be remembered. And the man who took the lead in this particularly was President Steyn, President M.T. Steyn of the Free State. And he wanted a monument by which to remember the women and children and to catch the imagination of a broken people, he said. And these are the members of the National Monuments Commission. President Steyn was very ill by this time. That's Herzog next to him on the left. And I don't know who the others are. Very all male to build a women's monument. And this point has been made quite a lot by people writing about it, and I'll touch on that as I go along. They needed £10,000 to erect this monument, which was a hell of a lot of money in a devastated country. And it took 4 years to collect the money in pennies and shillings. Young girls went around from house to house soliciting a couple of pennies here, a ticky there, a shilling there, and they eventually raised this £10,000. A remarkable effort of tenacity again and perseverance. Interestingly enough, the Free State and the Cape were the two who paid up. The Transvaal didn't. Transvaal contributed about half of what the Free State contributed. So this monument in the end is very much a Free State thing rather than a Transvaal thing. However, although it was a very all-male committee, there were certainly women involved in the monument. This is Rachel Tibby Steyn, President Steyn's wife, who I suspect was the moving spirit behind it. And Emily Hobhouse, who was there boots and all, very heavily involved, very bossy about it all. For a start, it's Emily Hobhouse's description of a scene on Springfontein Station, which is ultimately used for the central scene on the monument. The story of a mother sitting with this dying child on her lap. She had nothing to give it, the child is sinking fast. Emily Hobhouse wrote very movingly. There was nothing to be done, and we watched the child draw its last breath in reverent silence. The mother neither moved nor wept. It was her only child, dry-eyed but deathly white. She sat there motionless, looking not at the child, but far, far away into depths of grief beyond all tears. Emily, the man who designed the monument was Anton von Vaux, and I do not think that's Anton von Vaux. They didn't look anything like that. I think it might be J.D. Kestel, the Reverend Kestel, who was ultimately buried at the monument. Emily Hobhouse not only provided this, she didn't think much of Anton von Vaux as a sculptor. She says the poor man is only an inferior, though painstaking, artist and quite devoid of genius. And these friezes were actually cast in Italy, and off she went to Italy to interfere with him while he was doing all this. She must have driven him absolutely mad. But anyway, so she is there heavily involved at this time. And the monument then became a place for the commemoration, not only of the women and children in the war, but for a whole host of other Afrikaner moments as well. Albert Grundling, in this book that I drew your attention to, talks quite a lot about what goes on with the monument. And memorials change meaning over time. They have may have one meaning for people at the time and another meaning later on. And he, although he doesn't like that, there's some really angry feminist Afrikaner writing about the memorial as a phallic symbol and taken over by men and women are just the victims and all that sort of thing. I was not very happy with that. He says the evidence is not there. But he does admit that over time, increasingly, the male presence becomes much stronger on that site. You start to get, they build the War Museum of the Boer Republics, the Oorlogsmuseum, and although there is a part devoted to the concentration camps, it's nearly all about commandos and men fighting and all that sort of stuff. And then they began to erect these various bronzes on the site, and those are all male-centered. Emily Hobhouse was the first person to be buried at the site of the monument, and she's only one of only two women to be so honoured. The second is Tibby Steyn, and she's only there because her husband was buried there. The other two men who were buried there were Christiaan de Wet and J.D. Kestell, the man who I think might have been in that photograph. So this is the kind of thing that's happening here. These are much more recent. The Pitarenda one is quite recent. I'll mention the final bronze in the end presently. So there's the man off skate, the man saying goodbye, going off on commando, Die Mannelinge, which are, I think, the prisoners of war, and then Die Bitterreinde. And these, as I say, are all much more male-centered. And as I say, the memorial became a place for the commemoration of Afrikaner identity. And both Bill Nassen and I have used this quotation several times because he expresses it so neatly. When I was a boy in Bloemfontein, we'd be taken by bus once a year to a small rise outside the town on which stood a simple stone obelisk. There we would be subjected to a memorial service of suffocating boredom and a sermon of interminable length. But we all understood why we were there. We understood viscerally as children that the monument was not merely a stone expression of the evil that outsiders do. It is a symbol of how the Volksheer is fundamental to people's identity. Outsiders, people outside the Burgerstand, will always try to do you harm. The only solution is tight solidarity. Now, I found this particularly fascinating because I was a schoolgirl in Bloemfontein, but I, of course, was going to an English-speaking school. We never got taken to the Vrouw Monument. My mother took me, but we didn't go as a school. It didn't happen. So there's a very, where the monument, and I'll explain in a moment, was for some people, to be there to reconcile English and Afrikaans. Increasingly, it became a place for the expression of Afrikaner ethnic identity. But the monument, of course, is not the only place where the camps are remembered. Historians love this metaphor, the palimpsest. A palimpsest is a vellum or a parchment, which was expensive, where the people working on them would scrape away the old writing and then overwrite them. And so that's a real palimpsest. And it's a wonderful metaphor for the camp cemeteries because you get these layers and layers of commemoration and meaning in the local camp cemeteries. As I'll explain in a moment, sometimes entirely cleared and a whole new layer of memory and commemoration put in. And I could spend the rest of the lecture talking about these cemeteries, but I'll try not to. But visiting camp cemeteries is a fascinating exercise. This is Doornbosch. Orange River Station Cemetery. It's on a private farm, very much guarded by the owner of the farm, who's a woman called Rina Wiet. And it's probably the only one which is something like the original cemeteries, because it's been untouched by all the other people who've intervened. The early stones were like this one over there, one of the surviving stones in Matuli Camp. Most of them are very fragile. These are deteriorating fast. And I think they're very moving, but I went to Williston last year, and I discovered that in Williston, and I'm sure right through the Northern Cape and into the Free State, there's a kind of a folk art tradition for tombstones, and I'm pretty sure you're getting the same kind of thing going on in the camps with the decorations on these stones and this Williston stone, so I became rather intrigued by that. That's an aside. So initially you got these very early, very simple stones, but they're very fragile. They began to decay quite quickly. And then as people began to have a little bit more money, some people at any rate began to go back and erect their own stones to remember the posts that they've lost in the camps. And these are examples in different cemeteries, Vredefort Road, Wynberg, Springfontein. This one, Springfontein, is quite a grand family memorial. Somebody's got quite a lot of money to be able to put up something like that. Many of them are much simpler. But you get, and there's no uniformity to them, they vary enormously. But as time goes on, sometimes you begin to get these community commemorations, I think partly triggered by what's going on at the Vroa Monument. And so you'll start to get community memorials as well, and this is the one at Bethuli. Now, I'm just going to say a moment, say a couple of things about Bethuli, because there are a whole lot of other things that happen there. Bethuli Camp Cemetery is not in its original site. It was moved because of the building of the Gariep Dam, which used to be the Hendrik Verwoerd Dam. And they were afraid that it was going to destroy the site, so they moved everything. So this cemetery, for a start, is not original at all. And what you're seeing here with those rather neglected paving stones, when I went around in 2004, the cemeteries were getting very neglected. People are now, sort of, there's now been a resurgence of energy, certainly at Bethuli, and they're beginning to clean them up and look after them better again. But all this is 1960s, 1970s sort of stuff, apart from that memorial. And then, as time goes on, you get moments like the reenactment of the Great Trek in 1938. And where do you, in a small town, do you commemorate that moment? You do it at the camp cemetery. And so you get these kind of erections, like this one here, which is in Standerton Camp. And behind, I'm just going to comment about those granite walls in a moment, behind that. So that then is a commemoration of the 1938 trek. What they very often did, and you get this, for instance, in Petersburg Camp Cemetery, is that they would layer a layer of cement and then draw a wagon across, so you've got the wagon wheels embedded in cement. And you get that in quite a number of the cemeteries. So the camp cemeteries then are becoming much more than just a memory of the camps. They're becoming a memory of commemoration of Afrikaner history and identity in a whole lot of ways. And then when, we reach the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, and there's the apartheid government in power and Afrikaners are more affluent, the government steps in. The Burgeroorlogskomitee took over nearly all of the cemeteries, very many of the cemeteries, and they completely rebuild them, much grander. So you get, this is Vredefort Road, but you get it in many of the cemeteries. A grand entrance of some kind, a statement, often other memorials. Quite often in the Free State camps, you'll get stuck into the walls, you'll get a cuppy or children's shoes, that sort of thing. And then always these great granite slabs listing all the deaths. Now, the impact is very powerful. They're jolly hard to photograph because they're pretty shiny. And if you want the light on them, you get yourself reflected in them. And if you don't, you can't see them properly. So for somebody like an amateur photographer like me, they're jolly difficult to photograph. But every camp has them. And I showed you that one, where did it go? That one is Standerton Camp back there, that's another one. And you get them in almost, not Doornwald, but very many of the others. And here is Irene, which is the best kept camp cemetery of all. And this is one of these celebrations, commemorations on the 16th of December. And this is a completely revamped cemetery, nothing like the original cemetery. With these individual graves, but all very standardized, and then you can see these slabs there. And then in the end, by the 1980s, you begin to get some totally different kinds of places being erected. And the one that is quite extraordinary is Alawil North. The Alawil North Memorial is nowhere near the cemetery. It's on the road out to down to Port Elizabeth. You have to go and get a key to go in. And it's an extraordinary erection, loaded with symbolism. But there's the little bit about the erection of this thing. And on the side you can see coffin-shaped things, and then there are these slabs which each commemorate a proportion of the children who died. And then you get this kind of structure. That thing like that is a tent, and I've forgotten what all those symbols now stand for, but they all stand for things. It's heavily metaphorical. Interestingly, the figure around, who's the sort of central figure of all this, is the doctor in the camp, who is Dr. Hoekster, who was, I think, the grandfather or father of Judge Hoekster, which I think is part of the movement behind it. But I don't really know what the story is behind this Aliwal North one. Then you could see a bit more of it. So there are these whole series of layers of commemoration. And then we come to 1994, knowing that in 4 years' time, 1998, is the centenary of the start of the war. What do you do about coming to terms with black deaths? And this was quite an anxious time in some ways, I think, for those who were trying to set up the centenary celebrations. This is the new South Africa. How do you begin to bring black people into this? How do you handle this? And what emerges ultimately, certainly coming out of places like the War Museum, the Werdhof Museum, is an interesting position. It's now in the new South Africa. It's got to justify its existence. And they have worked very hard to try and make this a museum with a broader context. They've now revamped it entirely, and I think it's broadened out very considerably. But the kind of line that they have taken through particularly the work of Stoel Kessler is the notion of a shared paradigm of suffering, that both the blacks and the Boers suffered at the hands of the British. They were equal victims at the hands of the British. And as I say, the War Museum has promoted this concept particularly. I have some quarrels with it, because my problem with it is that I think it denies the very different treatment of black people in the camps. The second theme that is also developed through this kind of thinking is the horror of war. And indeed, that's a very... moves Emily Hobhouse, for instance. It's what people, when they're looking at women and children in wartime, emphasize always, that war falls most cruelly on women and children, particularly. But, of course, there was this question of drawing in black participation. And Thabo Mbeki was the one who seemed to come on board most. This is a memorial which was built at Brandfort, in Brandfort Camp Cemetery. They actually excavated a black camp at Brandfort. And Thabo Mbeki is said to have designed this memorial. It's the one memorial to black camp victims in any of the camp cemeteries. I don't know what its state is now. When I went in there, this whole farm was owned by a man called Paul Jacobs, who's now died. And I'm told that it's in a very poor condition, both the black and the white camp sites, that it's no longer cared for and it's not easy to get to. Take the time. I just want to conclude by going back to Emily Hobhouse, because Emily Hobhouse was invited to make the speech at the unveiling of the monument of the 16th of December, 1913. She was actually ill, so she never actually gave the speech herself. It was read. And my mind boggles at what people made of it, because it is a quite remarkable speech. The whole speech is given in this book, and I'm just going to draw attention to a couple of aspects of it. One of the things that she does is to ask for pity and forgiveness for those who are responsible for the suffering in the camps. Sorry. Alongside the honor we pay the sainted dead, forgiveness must find a place. As your tribute to the dead, bury unforgiveness and bitterness at the foot of this monument forever. Instead, forgive, for you can afford it. The rich, who were greedy of more riches, the statesmen who could not guide affairs, the bad generalship that warred on weaklings and babies, forgive. Because so only can you rise to the full nobility of character and a broad and noble national life. This is very different from the line which actually comes out of the camp, which is captured in those books by Elizabeth Maitland. Her first book was... they have three versions of the same book, but it's the English version, which was the first one that was published, was I Think We Must Not Forget. The second one in Dutch was Vergeten, and then the Afrikaans one is Mag Ons Vergeet. And it's this, we must not forget what happened, is very much more the theme of the camps in the years that follow. But Emily Hobhouse went further than that. She went on, we meet on Dingaan's Day, your memorial of victory over a barbarous race. Does not justice bid us remember today how many thousands of the dark race perished also in concentration camps in a quarrel that was not theirs? Did they not thus redeem the past? Was it not an instance of that community of interest which, binding all in one, roots out our racial animosity? And may it not come about that the associations linked with this day will change, merging into nobler thoughts, as year by year you celebrate the more inspiring Frauendach we now inaugurate? Plea of Abraham Lincoln for the black comes echoing back to me. They will probably help you in some trying time to come to keep the jewel of liberty in the family of freedom. And then she ends, which I haven't included here, with a sort of call for women to come forward politically. So it's kind of a women's lip cry at the end. It's an extraordinary speech. And it's difficult, well, I have no idea what people made of it at the time. But what is interesting is how very much it has a value today, and is how people are now thinking much more about these sort of things. I just wanted to conclude by saying very briefly that to me, one of the important things in studying camp history is that we live in a very complex country, a very multi-ethnic country, and a country where people have their own histories. And often people don't know their own histories. I found so often talking to English-speaking audiences about the camps, I've had people who come to me and said, we know nothing about the camps, we didn't even know about them. And I find this extraordinary, partly I suppose because I came from a family where there were people associated with the camps, and I was in Bloemfontein, and I'd always known about them. But nevertheless, this is the case. We have a whole lot of private histories of which are particular to our own societies. And I feel that it's only by understanding one another's histories, by making these histories part of a broader national history, that we're going to be able to build a more national society. It's a difficult project, it's never a project which is going to succeed ultimately, but I do think it's an important thing to do. So I thought I'd stop there. I've got a couple of questions which have been handed to me. I tried to answer the one about demography in the course of the lecture and the one about barbed wire, but I've had a couple of other questions as well. So I'll just take those quickly and then see if anybody else has questions. I had one question asked about Emily Hobhouse's context, where she came from. Emily Hobhouse came from a British liberal family, in other words, slightly on the left politically. She was very well... Her own family were very well connected on the political liberal left. People like Lord and Lady Hobhouse, her brother Leonard Hobhouse was an MP in the Liberal Party. So she's part of that group who became known as the pro-Boers. And the pro-Boers range from political liberals through to Quakers, through to the Irish, the very strong pro-Boer group amongst the Irish. The people who stood out against the war, who believed from the beginning that the war was a mistake. And just in answer to the lady who gave me the other question, I just would like to incorporate into that the comment that, of course, this is one of the features about Britain. You may have an imperial Britain which is waging an unjust war, but you also do have an element in British society which was arguing precisely that this was an unjust war. So that's the political context which Emily Hobhouse comes from. But in addition to that, she also comes from a different kind of tradition, or an associated tradition, and that's the tradition of women philanthropists, particularly associated with the Quakers, but not only her, which runs right through British 19th century history. So you get people like Elizabeth Fry, the prison reformer, or Florence Nightingale, I'm blank on some of the others, Octavia Hill, who's the one who's interested in housing. Angela Burdett Coutts was very, very rich, but also gave money for all sorts of philanthropic subjects, projects. And Emily Hobhouse is very much a part of that tradition of British philanthropy, and certainly educated middle-class women engaged in this kind of philanthropy. So she's got this sort of double background. The other question that I got, which you wouldn't, I took out of my slides, was a question about a disease called cancrum aureus, which comes up quite often in the camps. And cancrum aureus was a terrible disease which attacked quite a lot of the children, in which, and it's now called NOMA, if you look it up on the internet, NOMA. I don't know precisely what it was, but it was some sort of gangrene of the jaw where an abscess would develop and then it would grow and grow and grow, and it was ultimately fatal. It was not unknown outside the camps. It's in the British medical literature of the day. It was something which often followed on measles. I did wonder myself whether in camps where nutrition is poor, whether it doesn't perhaps also scurvy may not contribute to the ease with which it developed, because quite a lot of children died of this terrible disease, and it caused great fear amongst poor women. It was absolutely terrifying to watch your child slowly dying in that way. So that was that question. And then the final question that I had was a rather complicated one about race, and in which says, I mentioned that the British in India and South Africa regarded the blacks as natives, as inferior, to be managed and kept separate, with the white British as superior, worthy. Read that word, sorry. Worthy of more. The white Boers even superior to all the SA blacks. So are the British not the creators of apartheid? They made the first apartheid laws in 1938-13. No, they didn't, and I'll come to that in a second. So why are Afrikaners only blamed for apartheid? Which is a difficult one, and I'm not going to try and deal with it precisely, except to say a couple of things. First of all, that racism is a complex phenomenon. It's got a complicated intellectual genesis, and it alters over time. It emerges at different times, in different kinds of contexts, in different ways. But what is happening at this period, of course, is this emergence of a notion of social Darwinism. And it bites very deep in the consciousness of very many people, not only in England, but of course in places like Germany as well. And the notion of social Darwinism is that there is a competition for survival amongst the human race, and it is the superior races which are going to survive, but it's a struggle for survival. So it's a struggle between nations, between British and Germans, for instance, and this very much feeds into Nazi ideology later on. But it also contributes to the thinking of race in a sort of a hierarchy with Western, especially people from places like Germany, France, Britain, the top. Italians come a little lower down in the hierarchy, down to Africans or Australian Aborigines or people. So it's a hierarchy of race which descends. So this is the kind of intellectual context in which the British are often operating, and many of them imbibe it automatically. They take it for granted. This is how it is. Darwin proved it. And there's a lot of literature around this. I can't go into it now in detail. The other point, of course, is that when you're establishing an empire, you assume that you've got the right to empire. There's a kind of a sort of innate sense of superiority, and I have to say myself as a South African, that I'm sure, I mean, if you've been to Britain too, one does bump into this in Britain even now sometimes. But just to get back to British responsibility for apartheid, so yes, I'm not trying to say the British were not racist. On the other hand, I'm not trying to say that Boers were not racist either. The Boer republics particularly, the Boers moved up there to get away partly from British laws about equality. They go on trick. And the republics that they establish are undoubtedly racist. So I think one shouldn't leave that out of the question. What happens after 1910? 1910, remember, is union. What happens after 1910, however, is rather more complex. The 1913 Land Act is passed by a government under Louis Botha, who was the man who's trying to reconcile British and Boer, backed by Afrikaners like Smuts, but not all Afrikaners, of course. The man who took the 1913 Land Act through Parliament was that great Cape liberal, J.W. Sauer, who died almost immediately afterwards. And I've just been working on some of Olive Schreiner's letters, and she's torn up about that. She said, how could Jim have done this? How could he have passed this? How could he have taken an act like this through Parliament? So the genesis of the 1913 Land Act is a very complicated thing, and therefore a whole lot of reasons. So I think And I think I would finish up just by saying on this that many of us are very well aware that in the apartheid era, although I think some of the motivation by apartheid was to establish an ideal Afrikaner state, from which English speakers were excluded to quite a large degree, nonetheless it existed with a tacit acceptance of many English-speaking whites. They may not have liked aspects of the legislation, but as far as the race aspects of the legislation was concerned, to a degree at any rate, I think there was a tacit acceptance. So I'm not trying to say that it's only Afrikaners who are responsible for apartheid at all. What I am trying to say is that it's a much more complex phenomenon. And I'm sorry I've taken an awful long time to answer that question. So, anybody else got questions? Yes.
Excuse me. You mentioned in your earlier election that Lord Kitchener was looking ahead in terms of his legacy, if you will, to India.
Yep.
That he wanted to use the campaign in South Africa as a stepping stone to his own career.
Yes.
Given the fact that he was the architect of this scorched earth policy, he certainly, to me, must have realized the impact of the maltreatment of civilians on his legacy. I don't understand why he wasn't more concerned about the post-war aspects of what he was involved with respect to the camps.
Look, I'm not a great authority on Kitchener, I have to say. But it seems to me that Kitchener was the ultimate military man. It seems to me that his concern is very little with the political ramifications of wherever he's involved in a campaign. What he's doing is fighting a war, and he's concerned with winning wars. And he seems not to think beyond that. He has left statements about the Boers which are extraordinarily derogatory. I mean, he made some pretty nasty statements about Boers as inferior peasantry. He was a man who came from Ireland and the Irish gentry. I mean, he came from a mindset which could think about peasantry as inferior and dirty and that sort of thing. And whether it's just the propaganda of war when he speaks like that, or whether he thinks like that about the Boers, and it's probably a bit of both. He comes to respect the Boer leadership, I think, over time to a degree. But even then, he wants to move on. And we also know, if I may just add, that he is one of the architects of the Western Front, the man who was prepared to use the British, ordinary British people, as gun fodder in the trenches. And I always think when the Hampshire went down in 1916, it was a moment of joy for the British people. But as I say, I don't admire Kitchener. Yeah. Sorry, can you say it again? Well, I tried to tackle that in my first lecture a bit, and I think there are several reasons. First of all, there's a purely technical reason that most of the records in the old days in the National Archives, there used to be something called a 50-year rule, and records were embargoed for 50 years. So those records were not available for research until about the 1950s. And the very first book that you get on the camps then is Otto's book, which was published in 1954. Why there is so little after that, I think there's several reasons. I tried to explain that I think it's partly that people had a sense of knowing about the camps through the poetry, through commemoration, through all those sorts of things. I also think it had to do with the fact that it's social history. It's history of women and children, and that's not the kind of history that people used to write up until the 1970s about. And in Afrikaner academe, Afrikaners were much slower to move into social history. And I honestly think that many Afrikaner historians for a long time just didn't know what to do with those records. And I think that's why when they go back and write about the camps, you get the same kind of stuff being said. You can list the deaths, you can talk about the suffering, but how do you interpret this material in other ways? I think they didn't know quite how to handle it. So I think it's a whole set of reasons. And by the end of, I mean, I was lucky. I got this Mark, my colleague, and I got this really very big grant from the Wellcome Trust. It was a lot of money. So we had the money to put into it. Research on the scale, I'm sure Afrikaners could have found the money if they'd really wanted it, but there wasn't, I think, the mindset, the knowledge, the understanding, a whole lot of things to do that. But this is a supposition, really. I think I'm kind of close to it, talking to other people. Take you and I'll pick up the letter.
You mentioned the Brits had camps in Cuba and the Philippines. How did they compare?
They were far worse. They were far worse than our white camps. The mortality rate was higher. What was provided for people was very much less. There was much less of the sophisticated administration and bureaucracy than our camps. And consequently, the mortality rate was much higher. So our camps, relatively, were quite good camps, if you can call any camps good. And I wouldn't call any camps good. But relatively, they were much better off. Sorry, and there was a lady who had a question. Yeah.
Did Afrikaner not keep diaries in the camp? That's sort of my question. And the other one is, when did they start writing about the camps? How long after the Treaty of Marine?
With reference to the diaries kept in the camps, yes, some of them did. There's a very complicated story with relation to these sort of things. Like, I used Tant Min Fischer's Dachbuch. Now, I've had arguments with Liz Stanley about Tant Min Fischer. She reckons that diary is inauthentic. It wasn't kept at the time. Because it's in Afrikaans. As it happens, I've seen the original of that diary. And I know that it was kept earlier on. And there are other diaries which were probably kept. But the interesting thing that happened is that these diaries are kept in the beginning either in English or in this very simple Afrikaans. This is the era before Afrikaans exists as a language. And along comes all sorts of changes in Afrikaner society. The creation of Afrikaans as a language and also an increasingly intense Afrikaner nationalism. And what nearly all these people who kept these diaries do is to translate them into Afrikaans if they're written in English, or translate them into sober Afrikaans, pure Afrikaans, if they're written in Natal. And so, on the whole, we don't have many of them in the original. We've got these later versions, which is why it's tricky. But yes, there certainly are some, like Tant Min Fischer's, and this Johanna Brandt, who wasn't in a camp, but was at Irene camp quite a lot. There's a woman called Bessie Grobelaar, her diaries in the Free State Archives. There are quite a number of them. So yes, they did. Sorry, and I've forgotten the other part of your question. Very quickly, Emily Hobhouse began to solicit testimonies at the time of the war, because Where the Brunt Fell was published in 1902. Elizabeth Nietling was asked by Louis Buerta to tell the story of the camp people in places like Germany. And so she collects those 10 testimonies. She uses those Transvaaler testimonies, which were collected about 1904. So, and her first book, the English one, I think was published about 1906. So some of them begin to be published very quickly after the war. And then they go on coming out right through, and a whole batch of them come out in the 1930s. And there's still some being published. Yes. Sorry, I missed the first question.
The supporters of the British.
Yes.
The farmers, the English farmers who supported the British. Were their farms spared?
No, they weren't. Many of them, and my family was amongst them, left and went to stay with family in the Cape Colony, for instance, or somewhere else. Their farms were not spared, no. I do think that they were slightly better treated by the British after the war, and they go back home because they're seen as victims. So I guess they get much more, they're better treated in the way of compensation. They get the compensation money through more quickly. They get aid more quickly, that kind of thing. I don't know enough about this. I'm very conscious of this as a gap in my understanding. But surely it must have taken for some people quite quickly. You get the story of somebody like Sarah Rahl. She seems to have her family, who had a farm called Olifantsfontein in the Springfontein district. They seem to have had a bloody lot of money, thousands. And they could restock quickly and get going quite quickly. And once the rand gets going, the markets open up again. So for some people, if you're close to a market and you've got money behind you, you can probably get going quite quickly. But I think for others it must have taken for years, and some never did. Because remember, the next story of Afrikaners is the poor white story. And already by 1906 you're beginning to get inquiries into Afrikaner poor whites. So there are many people who never get re-established on the farm. So it's a different story depending on who you are. I would argue that the farms were very much more thinly populated after the war.